You're listening to an episode of a Wondery Plus exclusive series. To continue listening, join Wondery Plus and enjoy ad-free listening to over 40,000 episodes, early access to your favorite podcasts, and more. Find Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
April 1975, Los Angeles, California. John Dykstra isn't going to be late for this meeting. The 27-year-old special effects assistant drives onto the studio lot and pulls up to Bungalow 426. It's shabby, single story, and small. Pre-production offices always look like this. They don't always sound like this, though. He pushes the door open. Inside, it's dark. The director's back is to him, his hands on his hips as he gazes forward, totally immersed in the action. And this is serious action. World War II documentary footage projected on a floor-to-ceiling screen. P-51s and Messerschmitts in a dogfight. The planes swoop, shoot, explode. Without turning, the director comments. When he speaks, his voice is light, slightly nasal, but there's also something friendly in it, reassuring, like Kermit the Frog. It's all gonna have to look like this. Only, you know, faster, more intense. Han saves Luke. Luke drops a bomb on the Death Star. It blows up. The good guys get medals. Credits. The director turns around. He's short and skinny, 30 years old, with a jet black beard. He's in his uniform, blue plaid shirt, jeans, and thick glasses. He's not surprised at all to see this new visitor and greets him warmly. Hi, George Lucas. John Dykstra, good to meet you. To the side, on a worn leather couch, sits the producer. He looks reserved and thoughtful, wears an Abe Lincoln beard. He rises, switches on a light, and then introduces himself. Gary Kurtz. Introductions out of the way, the men take seats. This is a job interview, after all. Dykstra is 6'4", gregarious, with a thick beard, genius-level intellect, and a lot of confidence. He's waited years for this opportunity, since 1968, when he and his boss, the legendary effects artist Douglas Trumbull, did the effects for 2001, A Space Odyssey. Lucas gets right to the point.
Doug Trumbull tells me you're the guy. Says you're ready to run your own department on a picture.
What do you know about what we're planning?
Dykstra responds honestly.
Pretty much nothing.
I know it's sci-fi, and you want to see spaceships do what those P-51s did. But believably, fluidity of motion, the ability to move the camera around so you can create the illusion of actually photographing spaceships from a camera platform in space.
The technology to do that doesn't exist, but I think I can build it for you. What's the movie about exactly?
Lucas smiles and with some enthusiasm begins to break it down. The Jedi, the Empire, laser swords, talking robots, mile-long starships, hyperspace, a galaxy far, far away. By the time he finishes, Dykstra's head is spinning. Lucas leans forward, serious.
Kid, if you take this on, you're going to have to build an effects company from the ground up. You're probably not going to have enough time. You're probably not going to have enough money. If you're not up to it, now's the time to say so.
Dykstra thinks it over. For about 5 seconds.
I'll get it done. One thing, though. What's it called?
There's a glint in Lucas's eye. The Adventures of Luke Starkiller, Episode 1. The Star Wars. But we mostly just call it the Star Wars for short. None of these men know it. But as of this moment, they've just taken the first step on a journey that will change the face of cinema forever.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
From Wondery, this is American Innovations, and I'm Stephen Johnson. On May 25th, 1977, Star Wars was released in 32 theaters nationwide. As word of mouth spread, its popularity exploded across the globe. It gave rise to an enduring pop cultural phenomenon unlike any the world had ever known. Nearly everything about the original Star Wars films was iconic, particularly the special effects and sound design. A young George Lucas and his team envisioned something so ambitious and radical, it almost never came to be. To make Star Wars a reality, existing technology had to be utilized in ways never before imagined. New technology had to be invented. And they didn't have much time to do it. In this series of American Innovations, we'll follow the creatives, technologists, and even demolition experts that made that vision a reality. In 1975, George Lucas was a young director on the rise. His first movie, THX 1138, was a provocative and original sci-fi masterpiece, though it failed at the box office. Next up was 1973's American Graffiti. This movie helped Lucas prove he could please a crowd. It was one of the most profitable movies of all time. It made Lucas a millionaire and gave him the clout to breathe life into an idea he'd been kicking around since the late 60s. George Lucas envisioned his third movie as Buck Rogers meets Flash Gordon meets Seven Samurai meets, well, every archetypal hero's journey since the dawn of storytelling. Lucas knew that in order for his space opera to work, the visual effects would have to outshine all visual effects that had come before. Special effects artist John Dykstra was just the right, hungry, brilliant idealist for the task. Lucas wanted his effects team to be independent of the film industry establishment. He didn't have much of a choice anyway. Simply, there weren't any special effects companies that could handle the creativity and innovation needed to make the Star Wars. Lucas gave Dykstra free rein to choose the personnel of the visual effects department, with emphasis on hiring the young, non-union, and ingeniously talented. This unprecedented company would race against time to do the impossible and at times clash with their director. The truth was, George Lucas knew that he could hire the best concept artist, cast, composer, costume designer, and set builder in the world. But none of that would matter if the scene set in space looked cheesy and fake. This now legendary team had no idea back in 1975 that they were working on arguably the biggest and most impactful motion picture in history. They would defy the odds to get it done. Their epic struggle to fulfill their destiny is the story of American Innovations' Star Wars. This is Episode 1, 6842 Valjean Avenue. It's late May, 1975. George Lucas stares at the drab concrete warehouse. John Dykstra can see his new boss is frowning. Sorry, what was that, George?
I said I hate it.
6842 Valjean Avenue in Van Nuys is in the arid, flat central San Fernando Valley, about 8 miles north of downtown LA. The building is across the street from an airport. There's going to be a lot of shouting involved here. Lucas and Dykstra are joined by Gary Kurtz, who found this place, along with Dykstra's hand-picked staff, hired to get this facility up and running. There's Grant McCune, 32, biograd turned lab technician turned model builder. Jerry Greenwood, 36, former actor who made the pivot to the technical side of the business. He'll build the special mechanical equipment for this movie. There's also a production manager, additional model makers, electricians, and Richard Edlund, 34. He'll get the camera department underway. Fun fact about Richard Edlund, on several occasions, his hand was used to play The Thing on the Addams Family TV show. It's time for the tour to begin. Dykstra leads the way. As they walk through the space, Lucas literally turns up his nose. Dykstra catches this.
Okay, I know it smells like a gym locker, but trust me, this is what we need.
The group looks around at this gross, empty cement cave. There are no walls on the inside, no offices yet, no equipment, no air conditioning. And it's about to be June in the valley in Southern California. That's certainly not going to help the stench. Still, Dykstra excitedly lays out his vision, pausing periodically to tape off sections of the floor.
So over here, we put the two optical printers, and just over there will be the rotoscope department. There's enough space in the back for two shooting stages. And against that wall, the model shop. Next to that, machine shop. Over here, wood shop. My office will be here. Okay, you'll see the second floor is a lot smaller than the first, but there's still a ton of room for what we need to put up here. Editorial, animation, art department, boom, boom, boom. Out, and we can squeeze our screening room in right here.
Dykstra can see that maybe, slowly, Lucas is beginning to accept the concept. Dykstra points straight up.
Plus, check out these ceilings. See how high they are? It's 24 feet to the bay. We can put lights up real high to get the angles we need, or we can have the camera on the ceiling to get a good wide shot looking down.
Lucas nods, but he'd rather set up shop in Northern California, closer to his home outside San Francisco.
You might be able to have that one day, George, but you gotta trust me on this. The Bay Area doesn't have the film development labs we need or the color processing shops.
Kurtz backs Dykstra. He reminds Lucas that they have 350 effects shots to make and only $2 million to make them with. This is the perfect facility. It's out of the way and the rent is cheap. Besides, they're in a rush. As of now, the plan is to release The Star Wars around Christmas of 1976. Lucas just stares off into the distance, mulling it over, while the rest of the team stands in suspense. Finally, Lucas speaks. Industrial light and magic. Dykstra and Kurtz look at each other confused. Lucas explains.
That's what we'll call this place. We're in this industrial park in Van Nuys using light to create magic. Industrial light and magic.
Kurt smiles at Dykstra. That was Lucas giving the seal of approval. Just before he turns to leave, Lucas looks back at Dykstra.
Well, you better get to work, kid. Clock's ticking.
ILM officially went into production just days later, June 1st, 1975. Over the next 6 weeks, walls went up, equipment moved in, and staff was hired. 25-year-old Joe Johnston was one of those new hires. He was entrusted with initiating ILM's art department. The blonde Texas native had already made a name for himself as an inspired effects technician and concept artist. He'd planned to spend the summer lounging at the beach. That was until ILM's production manager called and said, "Hey, Joe, want to come out to Van Nuys and help us make a space movie?" Johnston was going to decline until he saw ILM for himself. A bunch of people his own age setting up cutting-edge effects equipment themselves. Vivid and transcendent concept paintings of spaceships, heroes, and villains and droids drafted by the masterful Ralph McQuarrie. Johnston quickly changed his mind about taking off the summer and got to work. On Johnston's first day, Dykstra walks up with prototype models of Imperial TIE fighters and Rebel Alliance X-Wings. He's also got Han Solo's vessel, which he's simply calling the pirate ship.
All right, Joe, what do you think of these? Oh, they're beautiful. Really great work. I agree, but they're going to need a few adjustments, and that's where you come in. What do you have in mind?
Dykstra tugs on the Rebel fighter.
This is an X-Wing. Luke Starkiller flies this. But I need the wings to be a little wider here, or they won't show up on blue screen. Then for the pirate ship, I need you to draw us a version that's a little fatter here, see? I need to be able to fit suspension bars in. And also, see what you can do about the cockpit. I gotta fit a light in there. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Now, aesthetically, like, what are we thinking? Gleaming, kind of futuristic, or...
Dykstra cuts him off.
Exact opposite. George wants them to look secondhand, old and beat up. He calls it used universe.
Johnston nods. This movie is really going to be different.
I can get you about a dozen sketches by the end of the day. I'm just curious, how are we going to actually film this stuff?
Dykstra loves it when people ask him this question.
Well, let me show you.
Dykstra leads Johnston over to the pride and joy of ILM. It's currently under construction, but Johnston can tell right away he's looking at about $60,000 worth of hardware. Tracks, war surplus drives, stepping motors, lenses, and more. Dykstra beams with pride and says, "This is what's going to make the Star Wars different from everything that's come before. Lucas wants dozens of spaceships dogfighting in space. So how would we do that?" Johnston knows the answer to that one. Take one piece of film with the spaceship model. Put that on top of a piece of film with just a starfield. Put that on top of a piece of film with just the lasers, then combine it all with the optical printer so it looks like one shot.
Exactly. But if you're capturing each element one at a time, camera moves are out of the question. I mean, there's no way for a cameraman to repeat the exact same moves over and over again. The shots wouldn't match up.
Dykstra grins. The camera system we're building here fixes all of that. Theoretically, a device like this has been possible for a while, but this is the real deal. Better electronic guidance, better mechanical drive mechanism. It's called the motion control camera. Machine master Jerry Greenwood has been eavesdropping. He pipes up with a grin.
It's called the Dykstra Flex.
Dykstra waves Greenwood off.
You don't have to call it that. Anyway, the Star Wars is going to have around 350 shots with as many as 7 to 8 elements per shot. Motion control combines a uniquely designed camera with a special patented mechanical rig. And the whole thing's controlled by this specialized electronic control system. Then we command the camera to repeat the same move again and again and again on each element. You understand?
Joe Johnston can't believe what he's just heard. Movies couldn't depict shots of spaceships flying through space unless the camera was perfectly still. The stillness of the camera was a dead giveaway that the shot was fabricated. This Dykstraflex will be able to convey the illusion of space travel like no movie before. Johnston excitedly lists the possibilities.
You can watch a spaceship approach from a distance, pan alongside it, and then watch it go away, 180 degrees. Just like real live action photography. And if you mess it up the first time, it's okay. Just program the camera to do the same move again until it comes out right. That's incredible.
Dykstra nods, then looks down lovingly at the Dykstra Flex. It's far from complete, but it's taking shape. Johnston can see where the camera will be mounted on a crane, attached to a platform that will roll back and forth on tracks. It'll be incredible, all right. But it's just the beginning. Dykstra sighs.
I mean, it's just a workhorse device. One day, maybe we can get computers involved. That'll really change the game.
From summer into the fall, the burgeoning effects wizards work hard designing and building a fleet of magnificent and fantastic spaceships. One of the ships, however, has an unseen flaw. It may be the first major roadblock these technologists face, but it certainly won't be the last. thanks to The Art of Shaving for sponsoring our show. Shaving. You know you'll look great, but it can be such a chore. The Art of Shaving was created to help men enjoy every moment of their shave by elevating it from a mere act to, well, an art. The Art of Shaving began with a husband and wife devoted to helping men solve everyday shaving issues. Their original recipe for pre-shave oil soon evolved into a complete start-to-finish shaving ritual called the Four Elements of the Perfect Shave. They've gone on to develop the ultimate male grooming experience with products for beards, skincare, body, and fragrances. Elevate your shaving routine. Listeners of American Innovations can get 15% off their first order at The Art of Shaving by using the promo code AI. Experience the perfect shave for yourself or discover perfect gifts for every guy by visiting The Art of Shaving's 100 stores or going to theartofshaving.com. Just enter promo code AI at checkout to get 15% off your first order. And learn to love grooming again at The Art of Shaving.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
It's November 1975. George Lucas visits the Van Nuys model shop in person to deliver some bad news.
Han Solo needs a new pirate ship. The one you guys built isn't going to work.
Oh.
What's wrong with it? I saw a commercial last night for this show, Space 1999. The main starship in that looks just like our pirate ship. Shaft-like structure with rockets in back and a cockpit up front. The pirate ship is the most important spaceship in the movie. If even one person thinks we ripped off Space 1999, the Star Wars won't work.
Lucas, Dykstra, and Johnston hunker down around the drafting table, trying to build a new ship for Han Solo. Lucas throws out ideas. Johnston sketches away.
Let's make it round, Joe.
Like a flying saucer?
No, more like a flying hamburger? Radial shape. Completely different from everything else anyone's ever seen.
Yeah, that's good. Make the engines bigger. Make it feel like a hot rod.
The idea should be that it's a smuggler's freighter with a lot of modifications.
Dykstra makes a suggestion.
Joe, move the cockpit from the top to the side.
Yeah, perfect.
Lucas was happy. He jokingly nicknamed Han Solo's new ship the Pork Burger. But it seemed like a waste to just dump the original pirate ship in the trash, especially since it cost $25,000 to build. Lucas came up with a solution. What if the original pirate ship was the Rebel Blockade Runner instead? The Rebel Blockade Runner would be the first ship seen in the movie. ILM was relieved their hard work didn't go to waste. One last problem, though. The new Rebel Blockade Runner didn't have a cockpit anymore. It got cut and pasted onto the pork burger. Johnston suggested that the front of the blockade runner could look like the front of a hammerhead shark. Lucas loved it. Modeler Grant McCune next took two cardboard buckets, filled them with styrofoam, covered that in paper, and then decorated the paper with styrene and model parts. Boom. The Rebel blockade runner now had a cockpit, and the pork burger got a new name, Millennium Falcon. Over the next several months, ILM continued to develop, test, and build the technologies needed to make the Star Wars a reality. In January 1976, Carrie Fisher, Mark Hamill, Harrison Ford, and Sir Alec Guinness were cast as the film's heroes. Principal photography commenced in Tunisia at 6:30 a.m. on Monday, March 22nd. The shoot was a disaster from minute one. The weather, crew, and on-set practical effects refused to cooperate, and Lucas was unhappy with most of the footage. But there was no turning back. Back in the States, ILM had run into serious troubles of its own. It was way behind schedule. Lucas's vision was unprecedented and uncompromising. To bring it to life, Dykstra and his team had to explore equally new technologies. But the R&D process was time-consuming and unpredictable. One such technology was blue screen. A precursor to green screen, blue screen could save the crew a ton of time with their compositing work, if they could get it to work. But so far, R&D was just pushing them further and further behind schedule. This officially became a huge problem in May of 1976. By then, Lucas and the crew were in England, shooting scenes on the Death Star and Millennium Falcon sets. To make the shoot work, they needed pre-filmed effects footage, or front projection plates, from ILM. But ILM didn't have the plates ready. Lucas and his team needed the front projection plates to create the convincing scene. When Alec Guinness stares out of the cockpit of the Millennium Falcon and declares, "That's no moon, it's a space station," what the actor and audience are actually looking at is special effects footage projected into the windows of the Falcon with front projection plates. At least, that's the way it was supposed to work. Lucas received 60 plates or clips of effects footage from ILM for use in front projection. Every last one was unusable. Some weren't lit right. Some were just plain out of focus. Lucas demanded Dykstra jump on a plane immediately and personally explain himself on the set at Elstree Studios, 45 minutes outside of London. And so, that's what Dykstra does.
Let's get our stormtroopers lined up outside the gateway to the Falcon. Quickly, please. Thank you.
Dykstra finds Lucas bundled up in a director's chair. Gary Kurtz stands nearby and reviews the latest progress reports. Both director and producer look miserable and sick. Lucas's appearance suggests he hasn't eaten or slept in days. The movie is 9 days behind schedule.
Lucas lost his voice 3 days ago. It has yet to return. He glares.
"Well, look who it is. The genius that sent me 60 useless front projection plates."
Dykstra knows he's in the hot seat, knows Lucas has good reason to be frustrated. Dykstra is disappointed in himself. He feels like he's let the whole production down. Still, they might have an opportunity here.
"George, I really don't know what happened. I'm sorry. Look, I know we screwed up, but front projection is a flawed technology, and it's hard for the actors to react convincingly to it. I want us to try something different, something that's guaranteed to work."
"I'm listening."
"Blue screen. Everywhere we were going to put front projection, we put blue screen instead. The actors have to use their imaginations a little more, sure, but at least they can deliver the lines at their own pace, and the backgrounds don't have to look perfect in the moment you're shooting them."
Gary Kurtz frowns. Blue screen is cutting-edge technology, largely untested in the Hollywood film industry. Actors aren't used to it. And now Dykstra wants to entrust the fate of the movie to it? The release date was recently pushed back from December 1976 to May 1977. That buys them all some extra time, but is it enough?
"So basically, John, what you're telling us is that your plan is to just stick blue screen up everywhere now and figure out the rest later?"
"I know how that sounds, but yeah. We have about a year until this movie is in theaters, and we now have 10 more shots to add to the list. That's 360 shots to get done, of which you have completed exactly zero. From this day forward, you need to average about one completed shot a day. I'm going to ask you a question, and I want you to think carefully before you answer. Are we going to finish on time or not?" Dykstra takes a moment. He knows that it's all on the line. The success of this movie, his own career and reputation. He gives the best answer he can. "If things go right, yeah, we can do that." The only problem was, on the Star Wars, almost nothing had gone right so far. It's Friday, July 16th, 1976. Elstree Studios.
The last scene of principal photography is the moment we meet Darth Vader for the first time. The script page reads, "The awesome, 7-foot-tall Dark Lord of the Sith makes his way into the blinding light of the main passageway." Lucas orders about 4 takes.
And cut. All right. Thanks, David. I think we got it. That's a wrap on the Star Wars.
The next day, he's on a plane back to the States. He tries to think about the film as little as possible, but can't help himself. He visits Steven Spielberg, who was on set in Mobile, Alabama, shooting the arrival of the mothership for Close Encounters. Spielberg has never seen his friend so depressed, but he likes the production stills Lucas brought with him.
Oh, these look great. Oh, there's Luke Starkiller. Fantastic. Skywalker. It's Luke Skywalker now. Starkiller was starting to give me Charles Manson vibes, so I changed the name. Also, I dropped the from the title. We're just calling it Star Wars now. I gotta tell you, buddy, I think Star Wars is gonna turn out better than you think. Or worse. We'll see.
Lucas leaves to catch the next flight to California. On August 1st, he pulls up to ILM in Van Nuys. Lucas needs to see good lighting and convincing motion. He needs to feel like he's looking at actual starships in space, not models set against a backdrop in a San Fernando Valley warehouse. What Lucas finds at 6842 Valjean Avenue that day is indeed worse than he'd ever feared. He looks around in disgust at the lack of progress. Forget good versus bad shots. There are still hardly any shots at all. He angrily confronts John Dykstra inside Dykstra's office. It's cramped and cluttered with stray film negatives and sandcrawler models.
"You've been here a year. You've spent $1 million, and what do you have to show for it? The escape pod ejecting from Leia's ship and spiraling down towards Tatooine? Okay, great. You've still got about 358 shots to go and only 8 months to get them."
"George, believe me, we are..."
"I don't think you quite understand the critical nature of making a movie. All the pieces have to fall together."
Lucas storms out, then boards a plane for the Bay Area, where Star Wars is being edited, in part by his wife, Marcia. As soon as the plane touches down, Marcia can see her husband is not okay.
"George, what's wrong?"
I don't know."
He clutches his chest. The color begins to drain from his face. Marcia fears it's a heart attack.
"I'm taking you to the hospital."
The doctor concluded that this wasn't a heart attack, but it was exhaustion and hypertension brought on by stress. Well, it's official. Star Wars is practically killing him. Lucas knows something has to change.
When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
It's August 1976. And George Lucas is recovering from his visit to the hospital. And he's newly determined to get this film done the right way. Once he returns home, he calls his producer, Gary Kurtz.
"Gary, ILM is not working out. It's time for some serious changes. Have you been down there lately? It's like a frat house. It's way too laid back. We need to do something." "Look, Dykstra's a sharp guy, that's obvious. The Dykstraflex is amazing, I'll give him that. But things can't be this inefficient. Mondays and Tuesdays, I will personally be there all day to keep the pressure on. I want a seasoned production supervisor in there the rest of the week, cracking the whip. No more experimenting. ILM is no longer a research facility. As of today, it is a true production unit."
By mid-September, ILM is a very different place. No more downtime, mandatory completion of 5 shots per day. But the explosions aren't looking right. X-Wings, TIE Fighters, and ultimately the Death Star must blow apart spectacularly. But no matter what Dykstra and his team try, the explosions look cartoonish. Unacceptable. Lucas is very specific about how he wants it to look when a starfighter blows up. Dykstra explains to his newly hired demolitions expert, Joe Viscosal.
So George wants the outline of the ship to be on fire. The entire outline should spark away, and then the ship blows, you know? Can you figure that out?
Viscosal ponders this dilemma.
What compound are you using?
Acetylene.
Well, that's the problem right there. Acetylene will just give you a few sparks, then the disintegration of the model. You can't get a real fireball like that. Tell you what, I'm going to try this with bigger explosives, magnesium gasoline and silt-based. I'll use squibs to electronically detonate, and I'll shoot it at 100 frames per second. That should do the trick.
Viscosal solution does the trick. The ILM crew is amazed. By October 30th, with just 6 months to go until Star Wars was scheduled to come out, ILM had a quarter of the required shots done, and they were picking up the pace with each passing day. For the first time, even Lucas was impressed by the quality of the visual effects being created. January 1977. ILM establishes two crews to work simultaneously to get the movie done. One is run by special effects photographer Richard Edlund, and the other by special effects photographer Dennis Murin, who has just turned 30. Edlund and Murin divvy up shots between them.
Okay, Dennis, it says here, Luke nosedives radically. My team will take that one, and I'll handle most of the Millennium Falcon shots. And I'll get the multiple ship shots, Y-wings diving together, we can do that. And we'll split up the Death Star trench stuff. That works for me.
The two men get to work. Edlund sets up an X-Wing model shot to be filmed with the Dykstra Flex. He improvises with what he has on hand, based off of what he sees in the moment.
We've got a little bit of light flare on that portion of the wing. Grab some cardboard, will you? Tape it on? Okay, beautiful, beautiful. Okay, rolling.
February 1977. ILM is moving fast, but not fast enough. Not wanting to argue in front of the crew, Lucas, Kurtz, and Dykstra have it out in the parking lot.
George, we are killing ourselves to make this happen for you, but there are very significant technical reasons why every little thing can't be done exactly the way you want it done. I can't be any clearer, John. The poster says, coming to your galaxy this summer. If we can't pull that off, it's going to be your fault. I can't talk to you guys.
Kurtz weighs in.
John, you know George and I respect your talent very much. But when we bring up a problem, you spend an hour just telling us why it can't be solved. Well, we don't need that. What we need is someone to say how we intend to solve it. There are a lot of great minds here, but it's like organized anarchy. And you have to accept responsibility.
Dykstra hears this and loses it. The job started great back in 1975, but since then, he's just been beaten up by these two relentlessly.
Yeah, okay, great. I get it. I'm the bad guy. I'm the bad guy here. Forget that I stood next to you and built all of this. You need a scapegoat? This right here is exactly why I want out of this business. I can't wait to get out of here when this is done and do something else with my life.
Dykstra just shakes his head. Emotion getting the best of him. He heads back toward the warehouse's front door.
If you need me, I'll be inside. I've got a movie to finish. And it will be finished on time. That's a promise.
April 1977. The movie is supposed to hit theaters in a matter of weeks. Everyone at ILM is in agreement about one thing. The most important shots of the film are not done yet. The first one to knock out is literally the first shot of the movie. The opening crawl disappears into the distance, and the camera then tilts down
toward the Star Destroyer chasing the Rebel blockade runner. Lucas consults with Richard Edlund.
We have to get this perfect, Richard. This shot sums up my whole vision for this movie.
No pressure there. Edlund preps his team and they begin setting up. But there's an issue with the models. The Star Destroyer model is only 3 feet long, but in this scene, it's going to fill the screen for about 15 seconds. That close and that long of a shot, there's a risk of it looking fake. Then there's the Rebel Blockade Runner model. It's 6 feet long, twice the size of the Star Destroyer. But later, in shot 102, the Rebel ship needs to appear small enough to fit into the Star Destroyer's docking bay. Building a new model would be a major construction project and extremely expensive. Edlund has another idea. He shows Lucas a test he made the night before.
So what you're looking at on screen, this is a test. This isn't the final version by any means. But with the correct lens, shooting distance, and angle, we can make this 3-foot Star Destroyer model look like an actual 5,000-foot long spaceship. I like it. But make sure there's plenty of detail on the Star Destroyer. Hire extra people if you have to. This shot must hold up to the highest scrutiny.
Edlund and Johnston put two guys from the model shop on the task of detailing the Star Destroyer, painting it, scoring it, adding bits and pieces from various models. This job alone takes weeks. Meanwhile, ILM had spent months building the trenches of the Death Star. It was also tedious work. The effects technicians created 3 different sized trench pieces that could be configured in an endless number of arrangements. They spent the next few weeks filming with the Dijkstraflex to cover the necessary dogfights over the Death Star, as well as Luke Skywalker's climactic high-speed trench run. Spoiler alert, Luke then fires 2 proton torpedoes that proceed to blow up the Empire's most powerful space station. And what about the explosion itself? Lucas, Dijkstra, and the rest of the team watch as demolitions expert Joe Viscoso wires the Death Star model for detonation. To make the explosion extra mind-blowing, he's brought a rare and unique toy with him. He's taking the business of filming pyrotechnics to a whole new level. What we've got here is a special trick 35mm anamorphic camera from Photosonics. It can run up to 300 frames per second. We'll blow the model itself with a special Titan blend of my own design. And when it's all done, we'll have a very convincing gas explosion. Silver sparks will come through and you'll get a faint gas-type aura. All right, now, everybody stand back. A week later, the crew screened the finished explosion for Lucas in the second floor ILM screening room. There wasn't any sound yet, of course, but they didn't need sound to know they had succeeded. The destruction of the Death Star truly impressed Lucas. When the explosion lit up the screen, the entire crew of Industrial Light and Magic cheered. When the screen went dark, Lucas walked out into the parking lot. At last, he could breathe a sigh of relief. Star Wars would be finished on time. ILM got the job done. Lucas is just relishing that thought when he realizes there's someone else in the parking lot with him. It's John Dijkstra. Dijkstra turns, smiles. Lucas smiles too. Star Wars is over. Their war is over. Both men are thoughtful, not quite sure what to do now. Dijkstra begins to say something, but stops himself. Lucas looks out towards the airport. Finally, he speaks. There's not a lot of people out there who can do what you did. You're asking the impossible of people. And they can do it or they can't. But you can't blame or fault somebody for not being able to do the impossible. By definition, it's impossible. Lucas shrugs. That's the best he's got. He extends his hand, and Dijkstra takes it. 2 weeks later, to the day, Star Wars hit theaters, and everything changed. Industrial Light and Magic was destined to not just change movie making, but reinvent it again and again. But first, they would have to make it through a production even more difficult than Star Wars. The Empire Strikes Back. In episode 2, we'll track the evolution of ILM as they continue to pull off the impossible through the next 2 episodes of the original Star Wars trilogy and beyond. I hope you enjoyed this episode of American Innovations. If you did, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, NPR One, and every major listening app, as well as at Wondery.com. If you're listening on a smartphone, tap or swipe over the cover art of this podcast. You'll find the episode notes, including some details you may have missed. You'll also find some offers from our sponsors. Please support our show by supporting them. And thank you. American Innovations is hosted by me. For more information on my books about science and the history of innovation, you can visit my website at www.stephenberlinjohnson.com. This episode was written by Hannibal Diaz, with editing by Lindsay Cradwell. Sound design on this episode is by Spoke Media. American Innovations is produced by Emma Cortland. Executive produced by Marshall Louis and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
Once upon a beat. Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me,
DJ Fuse,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the new kids and family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Once Upon a Beat.